again with Neil Pollack, who's most recently the author of Stretch. Neil, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm good, very flexible.
You're very flexible.
Well, actually, I'm very sore today.
You've been using that, I'm sure, a lot for these interviews.
Yeah, I'm actually not that flexible today. I'm actually more sore than anything else.
Well, I wanted to first of all start with a very general question, and that is, how does the Neil that is depicted in this book differ from the Neil who is I'm now talking to? Unless there's different levels of Neil that go beyond this, I don't know.
I don't think there is much of a difference. I tried to portray myself as accurately as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, there are things I didn't write about in the book because otherwise it would be, you know, 30,000 pages long, and I'd probably still be working on it. But I think that the portrait of me in that book is fairly close to what people who know me get.
Yeah.
And people who know me who have read the book say the same thing.
But you don't deviate much anymore in any capacity.
Yeah, there's not a lot of artifice. I mean, in this book or in my last book, it was pretty close to the bone.
Yeah.
And pretty raw, especially Alternidad. But I think, you know, this book definitely... I never set out to make myself seem like a hero.
Yeah.
I just want to, I have other purposes in writing this book.
Well, of the Wanderlust experience, you write, anyone who thinks of yoga as high-priced self-empowerment for the overprivileged creative class would have found a lot of evidence to affirm their thesis that weekend in Squaw Valley. You then write in the same paragraph that it was hard to feel like shit for long at Wanderlust. So I'm wondering to what degree you are embracing a version of yoga that is this high-priced self-empowerment for the overprivileged creative class, or is there no getting away from these class-related associations?
Well, I certainly dip into it every now and then. I mean, it's not like there aren't good teachers and good classes available, and it's sometimes I like to be a little pampered, so I may pay a little extra for a class. But most of the time, I practice at home by myself. And when I'm not doing that, I'm studying with a teacher who I've been studying with for years at a neighborhood studio. And, it's a donation-only, one of those donation-only deals. So, I don't think my point of view has changed very much. I mean, you know, like, I do appreciate some of the fancier stuff for what it is, but my day-to-day practice is very sort of humble and personal and even private, even though I talk about it in public. But I don't put on a yoga show because it wouldn't be all that impressive. You know, I'm not a gymnast. I'm not a dancer. I'm not an acrobat. I'm just a guy lumbering through a bunch of poses, trying to control his breath and calm his mind down.
But this whole scenario, by identifying it for the privileged creative class that it is, I mean, are you still aware of this? Do you still greet yoga with some degree of skepticism? Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it's marketed toward the privileged creative class, but not exclusively. And there are versions of it out there for just about everyone. I think there is a type of yoga for every person if people look hard enough.
It's hobo yoga.
Well, if there were, there really aren't hobos anymore, but. You know, there are a lot of sort of social service projects that yoga people do for, you know, homeless street kids. You can find half a dozen of those on the internet, or I did a story for Yoga Journal on yoga for returning war veterans with PTSD, and there's a community of people who do that, and there is a community of people who do yoga for homeless people. It's definitely part of the mix, or for pregnant mothers, unwed pregnant mothers. You can find all that stuff. So, while the predominant image of yoga is of, you know, hot milfs doing it in hot rooms, that is hardly the entirety of the culture. And so you can, you know, everyone's experience is going to be different.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering why you didn't so much chronicle these particular alternative forms of yoga, sticking to the ones that you personally experienced. I mean, there's a sort of journalistic quality, but ultimately it comes down to you in the end, and I'm wondering why you didn't stray from yourself as much. It's clearly, in this discussion, you have interest in, and you have sought these things out, particularly in your yoga journal endeavors as well.
Yeah, I mean, the book is a personal story. It's not. I did not intend to do a survey of American yoga culture. I said from the beginning when I wrote it, I'm going to write about what I encounter while I'm practicing, and I know of a lot of these other things, but I don't have a ton of direct experience with them.
Yeah.
So I didn't set out to write a survey, a journalistic survey of American yoga culture. I set out to write a, you know, stoner comedy about yoga.
Yeah.
With a sort of mild personal transformation angle.
But on the other hand, and I don't say this as a diss, but as a point of interest.
Yeah.
I mean, this book isn't to me just about your own personal experience with yoga. I got the sense of reading this of a man who, quite frankly, is really terrified of getting older. I mean, it starts with that review you got in the New York Times Book Review, which was, I think now is completely ridiculous. We joked about it before. Of a man who is terrified of being pegged as another doughy guy in his 30s. As a guy who is just looking for some either replacement or affirmation of his identity, but that sense of terror is there in your personal quest. And why do you feel that is? And how aware were you of this?
Well, the more I got into it, the more aware I was. And I think what it came down to is not necessarily a fear of getting older, but in the end, the main fear that all of us has, which is a fear of death, or as the Buddhists say, a fear of impermanence. And it's that fear of impermanence that drives so much pain and suffering in the world.
Yeah.
And I had that in large quantities. I had been doing all of this crazy stuff, and my ego was out of control. And a lot of that, I think, was just because I was trying to find a substitute for acceptance of impermanence. I mean, that's what you say in Buddhism. So, not like I'm a Buddhist, but it is it was very important to me to realize it, not just think, oh, I'm going to die, but to actually feel it in my bones that, you know, everything around me is impermanent. And that actually made my life a lot easier to live. I'm not nearly as afraid of getting old and dying as I used to be.
But that anger did come out during that New York yoga class when you saw the woman spouting forth political messages.
Yeah, I mean, there was all, you know, there was definitely, as part of the journey, I had these eruptions of anger and envy and just reactive behavior. It was not a smooth transition. And I think the transition is ongoing, but I definitely think I'm calmer and less angry and less envious than I was. And I'm happier because of it. I don't know if my writing's necessarily better, although I think it is, but it's made it much easier for me to move through the world.
Yeah. But the problem here is that if you are still erupting into anger, this is very much still a part of who you are.
Well,
you have to accept yourself for who you are at some capacity.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a large capacity, actually.
Yeah, I would say the yoga smooths over the rough edges. That doesn't mean you're going to behave exemplarily in, is that how you say it? I don't know. In all circumstances, but it will make you much more aware of how you behave in most circumstances. And so, you know, of course, you're still going to feel angry or be envious or say something stupid or eat too much or drink too much from time to time. But I don't know. It's just nice to be a little more thoughtful and a little more mindful of the world around me and of my body and my mind as well.
Yeah. But, I mean, for example, in Thailand, you complained about the cookie that they gave you, writing, Jesus fucking Christ, we paid them enough money, they could at least give us a proper cookie. I mean, this seems to conflict with the idea of ahimsa, where you're supposed to be nonviolent and not be disliking the world. You're supposed to sort of embrace it, you know?
I bitched to myself and maybe to a couple of friends. I didn't throw a fit and make them bring me another cookie. You know, it's not like... you lose all discrimination and judgment when you start practicing yoga. I mean, there still is food that tastes good and food that doesn't taste good. There are still good movies and bad movies, good books and bad books, people you like and people you don't like. That doesn't go away, but you don't take it all so personally, maybe, you know? And the fact that I wrote down a grouchy reaction to a bad dessert, I just did that to illustrate that, yeah, okay, so I'm still grouchy.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, but the difference is that in the past, that grouchiness or irritability may have been destructive, whereas now I just like to think of it as a character trait.
So things you say roll off you more now than they did before? Or?
Everything rolls off me more easily. Some things more easily than others, but yeah, I mean, in general, I'm much. It's much because of, you know, practicing yoga and meditation, I'm able to take things that happen to me more in stride. It's never 100% perfect, but it's you know, it's easier. And even publishing a book has been easier. Because a lot of stressful things go on when you publish a book. Yeah. You know, you're dealing with the editors, and you're trying to figure out how to promote it, and, you know, and then you're traveling around, and you're wondering if people are going to like it, if they're going to buy it. You have good reviews, you have bad reviews, and...
You have vicious reviews in this case. Paul Constant, I thought that was even far more vicious than David Camp, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, by comparison, sure, yeah. Yeah, that was a horrible review. It was really mean, but, you know, I stewed about it for a couple of hours. And in the past, I might have really stewed about it and written a, you know, some kind of, you know, screed in response and sent them an email and, you know, maybe even called them up. And I might have, you know, I might have made things worse. And in this case, I just complained to my wife about it for a couple of hours and then let it go.
But, well, wait a minute here, because with the David Camp review, I remember this because I've read your site for many years. I mean, you had the joke about it. And then when I read this book, I was surprised to see it come back like a zombie out of the blue. I mean, that this had been torturing you for a number of years.
Well, it wasn't torturing me anymore, but it was a key turning point in my life to receive that review. It was like, I don't think the review was entirely fair, but really, in retrospect, it wasn't that unfair. And it was just like somebody dumped a bucket of cold water on my head.
A bucket of crap, really.
Or a bucket of crap, and the establishment said, no, you don't get, we were not letting you in, you know? Sorry, you're a schmuck. And I to some extent he was right, and to some extent he wasn't, and to a large extent it doesn't matter. But it you know, it was a key turning point, and I actually am very grateful to that guy for writing that piece, because it set me on the path that really changed my life forever and helped me enormously.
So if I got you and Paul Constant together for a beer,
I would prefer not to meet him for a beer, just because
he's actually a nice guy, and he probably didn't mean it. You know,
I know people who work at the Stranger, and I didn't meet him, and I can't imagine. You know, if I met him, I would be, you know, I would joke with him about it, because, you know, I'm not a bad guy at the end of the day, and I'm sure he's not either. There was something in the book he obviously didn't like, and he went to the wall against it, and that's his, you know. That's why we have the First Amendment. I don't know. He didn't like the book. And all I can control is my reaction to his review, not his review. So I thought I did a pretty good job of that.
Do you still have any kinds of aspirations to join the establishment? I mean, certainly being in L.A. and trying to break into the film industry.
I mean, I don't know that I am particularly anti-establishment. I just have aspirations to be able to pay the bills, and, you know, and yes, I would like, you know, some commercial success, and I would like critical praise, like all artistic folk people would like. But at the end of the day, you know, it's if I can just continue doing what I do for a living, I'll be happy.
Yeah, I'm curious, going back to the book, why it deals so much with your bodily functions. I mean, the concerns of getting a boner while meditating, the description of your farts, the vomiting in the later part of the book. I mean, for those who are on the fence when it comes to deciding whether, oh, well, Pollock does yoga, maybe I might want to try it, that might be a tough sell for them. I'm wondering why you choose this. Is why your personal entry point to the world of yoga had to be predicated upon expulsion of various things.
Well, I mean, if you read any of my books, they all contain a tremendous amount of scatological humor. I've just always enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed writing it, and I think it's funny. Yeah. And these are things that happen to everybody, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody excretes in various ways, and
and you describe nearly every excretion.
Yeah,
I think you actually kind of even refrained, but you could have described every excretion.
I could have. I didn't. There's not a lot of sex in the book. Although there is that boner scene.
Regina has made it kind of off limits then.
I don't know if she's made it off limits. It's just, it just wasn't that germane to the subject matter. But I mean, you know, if you're going to write a yoga comedy, you should have a farting scene in it, you know? And
why?
Because everybody farts in yoga class.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that everybody who has practiced yoga can relate to, or at least had someone fart next to them.
Yeah.
It's not like it takes up, you know, dozens of pages. It's a little 3-page scene.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I always loved the vomiting scene in Blazing Saddles.
Well, the curious thing is,
you know, I like scatological set pieces, so I put a few of them in the book. And, you know, usually when I do it in the book, it's to illustrate some sort of point. You know, I barf in Thailand because I'd taken too many Xanax and had traveled all night and then tried to practice too hard. And there's a lesson to learn from my vomiting, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple others, there was something else that I'd done slightly wrong.
The curious thing, though, is who is your audience? The audience who came on board for Alternidad, or those who knew you for the Anthology of Literature, Nevermind the Pollocks, and so forth?
I don't know exactly who the audience is. Yoga people have been extremely supportive of this book. They, you know, anybody who has taken on a practice, even a semi-serious way, I think can really relate to my experiences in the book. It's an absurd culture, and the intersection between East and West is a source of, you know, endless comedy, and we all have experienced this, and we've all been through it. So they've been very supportive. But I don't see why people who read and enjoyed Alternidad wouldn't like this book. It's kind of a piece in a way.
Yeah.
And I honestly, the anthology came out so long ago that, you know, I don't even know where that audience is anymore. They're probably starting to have kids themselves, you know?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to also ask, for the trip to Thailand, you admit that you used a portion of your advance to pay for your trip, sort of like a very, very hard, you know, I'm going to lay it all on the line for this book. You write, though, yes, I was a 39-year-old American man flying to a yoga retreat in Asia without my family on Daddy's frequent flyer miles. This made me one of the most loathsome creatures in the world. I understood this. Why do you feel that you were so loathsome for doing this? Why did you feel this book would be incomplete without that trip to Thailand?
Well, I went to Thailand because I wanted to study with the teacher who was giving the retreat, and I found and continue to find his teachings extremely profound, and, you know, and they've changed my life forever. So I wanted to spend some time with him. So, and Thailand was the next thing up, and it wasn't, as these kinds of retreats go, that expensive. And I thought it would be cool to go to Thailand because I'd never been there before. So maybe I wasn't that loathsome. I don't know. It's just that a lot of times I feel like, you know, in these first-person narratives, if the writers travel, there's not a lot of self-awareness about their class status. And, you know, and I just wanted to explain to people specifically how I got there.
But loathsome is an extremely
strong
modifier.
That may have been a poor choice of words. I mean, there's nothing loathsome about going on vacation to Asia. I understand. Inherently loathsome. I understand that. So then
why use it if it was so strong?
I don't know. It sounded good at the time.
It sounded good at the time? I mean, there's another point where you write, a vast silence ensued, during which Regina weighed the possibilities of divorce, which is another really extraordinary thing to say. I mean, marriage is predicated, in the most successful ones that I know, are predicated on acceptance. I mean, the sense I'm getting is that the dark-edged humor that you had in your early books is now being turned inwards towards this, and I'm wondering why that is.
Well, I don't know. It's better to turn it on myself than on other people. You know, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't really consider the book to have that dark of an edge, really.
Yeah, but when you're really making supreme, I mean, going well beyond the territory of the self-deprecatory and into self-pity. I mean, just as there is a major difference between being a comedian and a comic writer, there's also a major difference between being self-deprecatory and being self-pitiful to some degree.
Yeah. Maybe I crossed the line a couple of times in the book, but I think overall it's still a pretty light read.
Yeah, well, it certainly is, but I mean, I'm just wondering, I mean, just writing about yourself, aren't you proud to write about yourself, to live the life you do?
I'm generally a pretty happy person. If there are aspects of myself that I find loathsome or, feel that are worthy of my pity, well, I guess that's really my business, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly your business.
It's certainly not as those feelings aren't as strong as they used to be. And I think a lot of what I'm doing there is kind of describing the way I was feeling at the time.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to the way I feel about myself all the time. But I don't know. I mean, I think there is anyone who has any amount of privilege at all, and I don't feel like I'm an extremely privileged person, but I think relative to the most of the world, I've got some privilege. I think, you know, to have a little bit of awareness of that and a little bit of, you know, sort of class hatred against yourself, I think is fairly healthy.
Fairly healthy?
Yeah, I mean...
Why not just even... You could go ahead and set the class variable, so to speak, at null and just concentrate on other people instead of ascribing a value to yourself.
Well, I spend a lot of time concentrating on other people, but...
I know you did.
I don't know. In that instance, I felt some doubt about what I was doing, and I just was trying to put it across.
Huh. At the end of part two, you express how happy you were to get together with this new group of friends through yoga class. You write, "There was no hero worship. We didn't compete or talk about transformation or say that we wanted to teach yoga to the children. And yet, I would argue, it could be argued, that this wasn't enough for you. The trip to Thailand that we just mentioned, at the end of the book, you pursue yoga teaching. Certainly, writing about your own personal experience here, I mean, I'm wondering if it may, in fact, be something of a detriment to your own personal growth because you have to chronicle what you're living instead of just living?
I don't really think it is. I mean, I made it a point to just write about what happens to me as it happened. There are a few instances in the book where I went and did something because I thought it would be good for the book, like taking a Bikram class, for instance. I didn't really want to do that, but I was like, shit, I'm doing a yoga book. I got to go do some Bikram. But even the sort of the set pieces, the Wanderlust, the Yoga Journal Conference, that was just kind of stuff that sort of came up. You know, I got this assignment, and then it led to me being able to go to a conference free. I was just curious. You know, I wanted to see what this was all about. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's not that exact group of friends, but I still practice with those people in that neighborhood. And I still enjoy that sort of sense of like small townness that I experience in yoga culture. And then, you know, once it's just like anything else, it's like you like to hang out at your neighborhood bar. And then once in a while, you want to go to a big show too.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't think it takes away from my experience of the world or from my writing.
Yeah. You know? But it's a risky proposition to live life and to, you know, have people place their trust in you and they know that you they may be written about at some point. I mean, do you ask permission of these various people? Do you inform them, "Hey, you might be fodder for my next book," or anything like that? I mean, you have to respect personal territory, and you have to respect your own personal territory too.
I made it just first of all, most of the people who are in the book, especially the people who I wrote about at any length, knew that it was going on while it was going on. They had no illusions about it. And I also made it a real point in this book, because it is a book about yoga, to be as kind to everyone as I possibly could, except for myself. Like myself, I felt like you should be kind to yourself, but I felt like if you're going to criticize anyone and make fun of anyone, it should be yourself. Because at the end of the day, you're the one who has to deal with that, not someone else. And so I made it, you know, I very consciously tried not to be snarky, tried not to be mean, tried not to make unfair judgments, and tried to really consider things. Like, for instance, I write about, you know, Bikram, the founder of Bikram Yoga, and he's a very controversial figure in yoga culture and much reviled by people, but I just found him entertaining, right?
Yeah.
And I could have made a lot more fun of him than I did, but then I thought, what's the point?
But cruelty to yourself is still cruelty, Neil.
That's true, although in the end... I don't think the final takeaway of the book is this guy's being cruel to himself. The final takeaway is like, oh, finally, this dumbass has calmed down a little bit.
You never quite answer the question, at least as you presented in the book, about why you wanted to teach yoga. I mean, you were asked it, and you cracked some joke like, I don't even know what Dharma means. Well, yeah. I want to ask you, why did you want to teach yoga, particularly since you know, we're talking about this. I mean, well, was it sort of a place to deposit some of this needlessly cruel energy towards yourself? Do you want to kind of replace it with something positive?
I like talking about it and to some extent teaching. And I did get a teaching certificate this summer. So,
well, congratulations.
Yeah, it was you know, quite, I don't know, I'm proud of getting it. It was a lot of, it was hard work and, you know, really gratifying. But so anyway, why did I want to teach? You know, it just had a, yoga had a profound influence on me, and I want to share that with people, and I think I can present it and talk about it in a way that may be accessible to a certain kind of person who previously would have rejected it because they think that they're not in good enough shape, or that yoga is for good-looking rich people, or that yoga is, you know, hippy-dippy or new-agey. And it's not necessarily. It doesn't have to be any of these things. So I think that there is a certain kind of person that might possibly tune in to what I'm saying as opposed to someone else. And so that's why yoga keeps spreading, is different kinds of people get into it and then they kind of put their own spin on it.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a really, like, my desire to talk about it and share it is very sincere. And, you know, and I'm really glad that I have that element to my life, because it's nice to be able to give something to people.
Yeah. I wanted to also talk about the journalism you do for Yoga Journal. I mean, late in the book, you offered the disclaimer, because I was vigorously doing asana instead of taking notes, I can't quote any of the song lyrics back to you. But you did work as a journalist before, as for the Chicago Reader.
Yeah.
And even while writing for Yoga Journal, you do, in fact, summon up a few of those journalistic instincts, and you call Maha Yoga to try to get the scoop about Steve Ross.
Yeah.
You know, and you lucked out with that Friday night chanting, but I'm wondering if you're kind of downplaying, I mean, why you're downplaying and why you're almost denigrating the fact that you do come from journalism and there is still journalism within yoga. I mean, why can't yoga have the same kind of in-depth journalism that, say, politics has?
I don't think, I mean, there, it can, and it does. There's a tradition of our yoga articles. I mean, the New York Times runs a yoga article every week.
Yeah.
Or every day sometimes. And I don't think that yoga and politics, there's just not the same amount of controversy in yoga. You know, there are
controversy,
or, you know, there are good stories to tell, but it's not like yoga needs to be covered every day by a beat reporter.
It's interesting that you use the word controversy instead of complexity.
Well, there are controversies, you know, like, for instance, you know, there was recently a little throwdown with Yoga Journal. They were putting out these ads with, you know, naked women in silhouette to advertise yoga, and this you know, old school yoga teacher named Judith Lassiter called them out, and then they were debating it back and forth, and it was controversy. It was like, is this exploitation, or is it just celebrating the body? What is yoga about? Who does it you know? And so that's that kind of, you know, and there was a New York Times magazine profile of John Friend, the founder of Anusara Yoga, who's a very wealthy and successful guy, and so that, you know, and the piece was not entirely flattering, and so that created some hubbub. And so, yeah, occasionally, like, a controversy does erupt, but in general, because yoga people are not, you know, are prone to let things like that slide much more easily, it's not, the rivalries that exist in yoga culture aren't as sort of earth-shaking as the rivalries that exist in politics. It's just not, yeah. So, but okay, so to go back to your point, I think that, you know, I'm still a journalist. I still write for magazines, and I don't think the two are necessarily mutually exclusive. All I was saying there was, you can't take notes while you're sweating like a pig and exercising at the same time. You just have to remember it and write it down later.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you would associate journalism first with controversy, because to my mind, and I mean, I've been doing this, I mean, you know, since we last talked, I've done like another 200 shows. So, I mean, this thing, which is my little form of journalism, for me, it's about understanding. I'm not out there to necessarily always get the controversial angle. I will ask.
Look, I'm not either. You know, when I write for Yoga Journal, I'm not looking for I'm not scandal mongering. I'm not looking to get people to say something that's going to, you know, sell magazines or papers.
Then why would that be the first thing off the tip of your tongue?
Hell, I don't know.
You don't know?
What
is journalism to you? What is yoga journalism to you? I never get to talk to a yoga journalist. I haven't actually talked to a yoga journalist.
Yeah, so. I would say, you know, good yoga journalism would be, you know, talking to people who practice yoga and getting a sense of why they do it and how, and what they intend to do with their practice. Just, you know, it's just like anything else. It's just storytelling. And that's all I do in Stretch, is I tell my story of how I got into yoga in my voice.
Yeah.
And one of the, whenever I meet yoga people, that's almost always the first thing I ask them is, how did you get into this? And they always have an interesting story.
Sure.
You know, and sometimes it's, you know, in my case, it's because the New York Times called me fat. And a lot, sometimes people were in a bad car accident and they needed a rehab. Sometimes it's a little more banal and they just were, you know, there was a class was offered to their gym and they took it. But there's always some sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting because yoga is so vast that there are kind of infinite numbers of ways people can get drawn to it.
Yeah.
And because of that, I see it as being, you know, it's a metaphor for the world in general. The world is endlessly diverse and full of interesting stories, and so is yoga.
Or a place to find acceptance. I mean, I to be completely clear, you also mentioned a very, I think, cruel thing that Dave Eggers said to you, which was, I want things to be straightforward from now on. I mean, for anyone to dictate to somebody else that they should be straightforward, I think is a really terrible thing. And that obviously had to hurt, and that also came roughly around the time of the David Camp review. And so I'm wondering if this was one of the motivations.
I don't know. I understand, you know. Yeah, it hurt at the time, but I understand why he said it. I mean, it's, you know, I was being a pain in the ass and kind of a dick, you know, and I just...
You know, some people, you have to accept them for who they are, you know?
I agree, but, you know, it hurt, but it's in the past.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
What about the fiction and novels that you last time we talked, you said that you really wanted to write them. What happened with that?
What's going on with that? I'm still working on a novel, and, you know, maybe someday I can... Publish one
again. I think you can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can go ahead and do yoga and become a certified teacher, you can write it.
Well, I've already written one. Okay. My first three books were fiction. It's just that the last two, you know, have been nonfiction. So now, you know, I sort of have a reputation as a, you know, memoirist, comic memoirist. But the fiction will rise again. There's not much doubt in my mind about that. I'm working on something.
Okay.
At some point, yes, we'll do it. We'll talk about my novel.
Absolutely. Well, Neil, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, man. It was a pleasure.
Baby, be kind.